The VP debate went very well. What's going on with World War III, the whole Iran-Israel thing? Senator Marsha Blackburn is here. We will discuss with a shipping expert this port strike, all that and more coming up on I'm Right. Well, that went well. Talking about the VP debate, of course. I love politics. You love politics. Well, we kind of love hate politics. And we watch these debates. I went home, sat down, my wife, my two sons sitting beside me in the living room, and we watched. And man, now, you know this is me. I'm happy to tear the GOP apart. Any politician, there are no sacred cows and never will be on this show. I don't man worship, so you know it's me, Cynical Jesse. That's the best debate performance I think I've ever probably seen in my life. I'm talking about, of course, J.D. Vance. That, for you aspiring politicians, that's exactly how it's done right there. It's kind of a, I'll do a couple clips in a moment, but kind of an overall picture. Walls was obviously not good, but his bar was very, very low, and he probably did better than I thought he was going to do. But no one thinks that today because he was so overshadowed by calm, cool, collected, pleasant J.D. Vance. Now, I need to explain before we get to the clips something. There were red meat things that a lot of people think J.D. missed last night. And look, for me too. Why, if you're J.D. Vance, why don't you hit Tim Walz on stolen valor? That's a really big deal to me. It's a really big deal to my veteran friends. Why didn't you say this? Why didn't you say that? Well, just strategically understand that last night was only about undecided voters. It's not about you. It was not about me. This was not a GOP primary debate. That teeny tiny sliver of the population that still, and I don't know why people are like this, still doesn't know, what do I go, Kamala Harris? I don't know, I don't really like Donald Trump. I'm not comfortable. The entire hour and 45 minute debate last night was aimed at that human being. Almost all of the undecided voters at this point in time are women. They're going back, they're going forth. So J.D. Vance had to get up there and present the gentle, happy warrior who loves his mother. And man, he nailed that. That was the overall strategy for last night. And that's why some of the red meat things that you may have wanted to see or I wanted to see didn't really make it into the debate. And obviously, the moderators were exactly what we expected them to be. As I explained yesterday, the Biden-Trump debate that ended Joe Biden's political career shook the system to its core. And from now on, you saw it in the ABC debate, you saw it last night on that debate. From now on, the moderators in the channel will rig debates in the favor of Democrats till the end of time. They are never going to let that happen again. And of course, that's why they made January 6th a big thing last night.
Would you again seek to challenge this year's election results, even if every governor certifies the results? I'll give you 2 minutes.
Well, Nora, first of all, I think that we're focused on the future. We need to figure out how to solve the inflation crisis caused by Kamala Harris's policies, make housing affordable, make groceries affordable, and that's what we're focused on. But I want to answer your question because you did ask it. Look, what President Trump has said is that there were problems in 2020, and my own belief is that we should fight about those issues, debate those issues peacefully in the public square, and that's all I've said, and that's all that Donald Trump has said. Remember, he said that on January the 6th, the protesters ought to protest peacefully. And on January the 20th, what happened? Joe Biden became the president, Donald Trump left the White House, and now, of course, unfortunately, we have all of the negative policies that have come from the Harris-Biden administration. I believe that we actually do have a threat to democracy in this country, but unfortunately, it's not the threat to democracy that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz want to talk about. It is the threat of censorship.
That's really well done. That's an issue. I'm not talking about for you or me. You know my thoughts on January 6th and our political prisoners. We're not going to go into that right now. That wasn't for you. It wasn't for me. That was for the woman who sits at home, still sitting there. Maybe she already has her mail-in ballot. I don't know. I don't like Trump. I am really worried about January 6th. How do you calm her down? And debates are all about timing. This is part of the reason J.D. Vance did so well and part of the reason Tim Walz stumbled. Tim Walz was nervous. He was nervous. That's why he was constantly looking like this, constantly writing things down, jotting things down frenetically, hands are moving like this, whereas J.D. Vance was calm and cool. Timing. When do you parry? When do you punt? When do you attack? It's all about timing. J.D. Vance nailed that last night. Now, that's the J.D. Vance, Tim Walz stuff. We'll get back to them more specifically in a moment. But I do want to just pause and take a little sidetrack here and discuss something. The border was a central theme last night, courtesy of J.D. Vance. Obviously, the moderators would prefer that didn't come up. But Tim Walz's answer here, it made me angry, but for a different reason.
Most of us want to solve this. And that is the United States Congress. That's the Border Patrol agents. That's the Chamber of Commerce. That's most Americans out here. That's why we had the fairest and the toughest bill on immigration that this nation's seen. It was crafted by a conservative senator from Oklahoma, James Lankford. I know him. He's super conservative, but he's a man of principle, wants to get it done. Democrats and Republicans worked on this piece of legislation. The Border Patrol said, this is what we need in here. These are the experts. And the Chamber of Commerce and the Wall Street Journal said, pass this thing. Kamala Harris helped get there. 1,500 new border agents. Detection for drugs. DOJ money to speed up these the adjudications on this, just what America wants. But as soon as I was getting ready to pass and actually tackle this, Donald Trump said no, told them to vote against it because it gives him a campaign issue.
I'm not going to get into that answer. I'm not going to get into the moderators. I'm not going to get into very much here. I am just going to once again remind you that James Lankford from the blood red state of Oklahoma tried to work with Democrats to pass an amnesty bill. It was not a border security bill. It would still allow over a million a year. Amnesty, it was just a wretched bill that James Lankford, in an election year, worked with Democrats on an amnesty bill. And since he did that, he has given cover to Kamala Harris during her debate. She brought it up too. And now Tim Walz during the VP debate, citing him by name, giving him credit, giving them cover. Democrats got elected and opened up the border on purpose, flooded this country with illegal immigrants. It should be the election year issue. And James Lankford of Red Oklahoma is the one who gave Democrats cover for that. So allow me to simply ask every single person watching from Oklahoma, are you going to primary James Naked Ken Doll Lankford out next time, or are we going to do the same stupid thing the GOP primary voter does every single time? What primary? I can't. Football's on. Or even worse, I'm going to go vote for James. He was in my church last Sunday. He seemed really nice. Can we please start punishing GOPers in the primary? All right, I'm not going to go off on a tangent. Actually, I just kind of did go off on a tangent, but we're not going to do that. Let's get back to the debate, the moderators specifically. J.D. Vance, you want to talk about parry and attack. When the moderators tried to fact check old J.D., which they were not allowed to do, whoo, boy, this is what he did.
And just to clarify for our viewers, Springfield, Ohio does have a large number of Haitian migrants who have legal status, temporary protected status.
Well, Margaret, but
thank you. Senator, we have so much to get to.
Margaret, I think it's important because
we're going to turn out of the economy. Thank you.
Margaret, the rules were that you guys weren't going to fact check. And since you're fact checking me, I think it's important to say what's actually going on. So there's an application called the CBP One app, where you can go on as an illegal migrant, apply for asylum or apply for parole, and be granted legal status at the wave of a Kamala Harris open border wand. That is not a person coming in, applying for a green card, and waiting for 10 years.
Thank you, Senator. That is the facilitation
of illegal immigration, Margaret, by
Thank
our
you,
own
Thank you, Senator, for
leadership.
Describing the legal process.
Kamala Harris opened up that pathway.
Those laws have been on the books since 1990.
Thank you, gentlemen.
The CBP One app has not been on the books since 1990.
It's something that Kamala Harris created, Margaret.
Gentlemen, the audience can't hear you because your mics are cut. We have so much we want to get to. Thank you for explaining the legal process.
Yeah, obviously we can talk about that hideous hag right there and her hag partner and hag CNN and how dirty commies are biased. I already explained to you why they were over the top. But J.D., well done, sir. Well done. And one final word on Tim Walz. Look, I've lived in the gray area of life for a lot of my life, but I've had a lot of friends that are a little rough around the edges. Been to prison. My friends apparently aren't as rough as Tim Walz's.
Yeah, I sat in that office with those Sandy Hook parents. I've become friends with school shooters. I've seen it.
Obviously, he misspoke. That's what happens when you're nervous. Man, what a brutal, brutal misspeak? Misspoke? Whatever. Anyway, all that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. It probably made you very comfortable. What a great night. Josh Hammer is going to join us next. Talk about the VP debate, a little foreign policy talk before Josh talks to you. Maybe you were a little hyped up last night. I was a little hyped up last night. I was excited after the debate. Woohoo, that was awesome. So, you know what I did? Wife and I were sitting talking about the debate. After the debate, after I went live on YouTube, did a little debate recap, I was sipping on a little cup of hot chocolate. Only this is special hot chocolate. This was Dream Powder from Beam. See, it's got natural things in it, like melatonin, things like that. Because I thought I was going to have trouble sleeping, but I didn't. I finished my hot chocolate, slept like a little baby, took off like a rocket ship this morning. That's what Dream Powder can do for you naturally. Sleep well and wake up even better. Shopbeam.com/JesseKelly gets you a huge discount. So go get one. We'll be back.
Senator Vance, the U.S. did have a diplomatic deal with Iran to temporarily pause parts of its nuclear program, and President Trump did exit that deal. He recently said, just 5 days ago, the U.S. must now make a diplomatic deal with Iran because the consequences are impossible. Did he make a mistake? You have 1 minute.
Well, first of all, Margaret, diplomacy is not a dirty word, but I think that something that Governor Waltz just said is quite extraordinary. You yourself just said Iran is as close to a nuclear weapon today as they have ever been. And Governor Waltz, you blame Donald Trump, who has been the vice president for the last 3.5 years. And the answer is your running mate, not mine. Donald Trump consistently made the world more secure.
Pretty good answer. Pretty truthful answer. Joining me now to discuss the debate, foreign policy, WW3, and other things, my friend, host of America on Trial, and author of Israel and Civilization, Josh Hammer. Okay, Josh, before we get to Israel and Civilization, Iran, the end of the planet, I hope that's not too dramatic, let's talk a little bit about the debate. I might as well toss this one to you. What were your impressions?
Jesse, I thought J.D. absolutely slaughtered it. I mean, I had high expectations, and he surpassed those expectations. In fact, I think it was the single most thoroughly dominant debate performance I've ever seen a Republican politician give in my adult lifetime. I mean, that is my actual unvarnished, straight, injected straight into the veins stance. I mean, every single question he handled basically as well as you could possibly handle. I mean, the January 6th exchange may be like not quite ideal, but I mean, he basically was like 20 to 25 wins and then like one draw as far as the questions were concerned. I mean, what America saw is someone who has done the reading, who knows what he is talking about, who was a public policy savant, who was keeping it civil and substantive. And, you know, probably even most important in this home stretch, he came across as very likable and relatable and a good guy. His shout out to his wonderful wife, Usha, was excellent, trying to kind of push back against this ridiculous left-wing disinformation campaign that he's weird or this childless cat lady's nonsense. I thought he absolutely slayed it, Jesse. And, you know, if the whole campaign can stay this laser targeted in this final month, I think that they're going to win come November.
Well, I hope you're right. No, he was dynamite. That's one of the better debate performances I've ever seen myself. Okay, let's shift off of that and let's deal with what's happening over there, Iran and Israel. Obviously, everyone knows who we're rooting for here. Let's get past all that crap. What is happening? What are the capabilities of Israel? What are the capabilities of Iran? Netanyahu has said a couple things publicly that sounds like a man who's hell-bent on regime change in Iran. Josh, what are we dealing with over there? What's going on?
Jesse, look, you know this part of the world very well. I mean, you served honorably mm-hmm. for for our country over there. I mean, you know, I think firsthand what we're dealing with here. Specifically when it comes to Iran, we're dealing with a jihadist theocracy that has been a stain ever since they overthrew the Shah back in 1979. I mean, that's really what we're dealing with. I mean, this is a country that has not had diplomatic relations, not just with Israel, but with the United States ever since 1979. I actually was speaking at a YAF conference, the Young Americans Foundation conference, a couple of months ago, and someone came up to me. Guy must have been in his late 20s. He spent the first 16 years of his life in Tehran. And what he told me was that from kindergarten through when he left, when he was in high school, their version of the Pledge of Allegiance in school is they put their hand over their heart and they say in Farsi and Persian, they say, "I solemnly vow to do all that I can to destroy the little state of Israel and the big state in America." They say that in school every single day. And they've acted upon that. I mean, they have literally acted upon this ever since the regime took over. It began with the infamous hostage crisis during the end of the Jimmy Carter administration. Ronald Reagan freed the hostages. And they fund a sprawling network of jihadist proxies all throughout the Middle East. They fund Hamas. Hezbollah is a direct proxy of the Iranian regime. The Houthis in Yemen are a direct proxy of the Iranian regime there. And ultimately, what they want is not just the destruction of Israel, but, I mean, I just told you what they want. They literally say it in school. They want the death of America. And we now see that they have ballistic missile capability of reaching at least anywhere they want in the entire Middle East within a matter of minutes. Those missiles took, I think, 12 minutes to get from Iran to Israel. That's really not a lot of time. So they clearly have gotten a little bit more technologically sophisticated over the past few years, which ought to be harrowing as they get ever closer to a nuclear weapon. Look, Jesse, I guess in summation here, looking at what's happening in the Middle East right now, looking at the death of the arch Hezbollah terrorist Hassan Nasrallah in Beirut, Lebanon. He was the Ayatollah's handpicked guy to lead Hezbollah. He was in there for 32 years from 92 to 2004, almost as long as I've been alive. Hezbollah is crippled like never before. And Hezbollah is Iran's insurance policy. Hezbollah was there to make sure that Israel does not actually go after the nuclear strikes. So with Hezbollah crippled like never before, and with Iran now doing for the second time this year, following April, this unprecedented assault, hundreds of missiles. Thank God there were no casualties. I think that Netanyahu was born for this moment. I think Netanyahu has been waiting for this moment, furthermore, for his entire political career. I think you're going to start seeing some attacks on the nuclear sites. I think you're going to start seeing some Iranian naval vessels start going down in flames, maybe some attacks on some oil fields. I probably stops there. I don't think they're going to go for the kill shot on the Ayatollah himself, but he's going to take advantage of this opportunity because he has to. I mean, this is an existential war at this point. And unfortunately, I don't see it getting quiet anytime soon.
Josh, from a numbers perspective, Israel's not a big place, obviously, as you well know. But it's not a big place. They don't have that many troops. Technologically, they are advanced. Obviously, they're a lot sharper intelligence-wise than everyone around them. And that has saved a lot of lives and cost a lot of terrorist lives. But I am worried about numbers. They don't have that many young men.
It's tough. Look, they have conscription. I mean, you have to serve in the military. If you are a young Jewish man, for non-Jews, it's optional. But thank God a lot of Christians and Druze and some Muslims do enlist in the military. They're stretched thin right now. There's no doubt about that. I mean, they've been fighting a multi-front war for a while now, especially with the ground incursion into Lebanon. But they're not running out of troops. I mean, we can get into the weeds if we want to. They had this whole debate about whether to forcibly conscript the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox Jews. That's a whole kind of domestic policy debate over in Israel. So they're limited, but they're okay. I mean, this is a militarily, technologically sophisticated country right now. Israel does not need troops. They do not need any foreign country to fight their wars for them. In fact, this is actually... It's really doctrine. I mean, the entire point of the founding of a Jewish state was that the Jews fight their own wars for the sake of the Jews' own self-determination, for their own destiny. So, I mean, that has been Israeli doctrine since day one. So they would never, 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 ever ask another country to directly get involved in their conflicts. If they actually do as I predict and start taking direct military action inside Iran, I think the only thing that is necessary from the United States is really diplomatic cover, to basically provide cover at the United Nations, things like that. Maybe there are a couple of heavy bombs that Israel is a little short on. They could use an ASAP shipment of. Maybe. I'm not entirely sure, honestly. But really, diplomatic cover is the main thing. Beyond that, I'm not sure a whole lot else is needed other than to let them just do their thing and patrol their own region from our mutual enemies.
Yeah, it's go handle their business. All right, Josh, I cannot let you go without asking about lawfare. There's a lot. Trump, it seems like it was only 10 minutes ago, he was facing felony cases in every jurisdiction in the United States of America. Now we don't hear very much about any of it anymore. Is it all gone? Is it all going to come rushing back in next week? Where are we at with all this?
Well, it hasn't really gone anywhere, to be honest with you. It's fallen off our radar a little bit because the world is basically on fire. As you just said, I mean, we have horrific biblical level flooding in Western North Carolina. We have this longshoreman strike. We have the brink of potentially all out war in the Middle East. So it's still happening. It's just fallen off our radar a little bit. So, I mean, so-called special counsel Jack Smith, by the way, I love to call him so-called special counsel because Judge Aileen Cann in Florida accurately ruled that he's not a legitimate special counsel, but Jack Smith is still bringing his case in Washington, D.C. And by the way, if he were a reasonable prosecutor, he would have dropped that case a very long time ago. He's doing so in direct defiance of multiple Supreme Court opinions, in direct defiance of the Trump versus United States immunity case, in direct defiance of the Fisher case, which pertained to subsection 1512 for the J6ers. He left in those two charges on that same statute in the indictment. But what he's trying to do, Jesse, his most recent court filing is trying to make public large swaths of his 180-page legal brief in the January 6th case. Let's think about this. We're in October. Why would Jack Smith want to make public a lot of January 6th material right before an election? It's obviously election interference. There is no other reason to do this. In fact, the Department of Justice's own internal manual, there's a justice manual, direct part of the manual that says you cannot make any prosecutorial decision if there would even be a perceived effect of putting a thumb on the scale of the election. Jack Smith doesn't care for such niceties because the Democrat lawfare complex has one goal and one goal in mind, which is all-out victory. They won't let anything get in their way. The other case is just real quick. The Florida case, classified docs, we're waiting on an appeal at the 11th Circuit based in Georgia. The New York case, sentencing was pushed until after the election. The other case, the Georgia case, is actually going to come back on our radar in the next 2 to 3 weeks as well because the Court of Appeals there in Georgia is going to reconsider Fani Willis's dismissal or lack thereof. So it's all happening, Jesse. It's just a little bit more in the background.
He is Josh Hammer. His new book is Israel in Civilization. If you know Josh like I do, I'm sure it will be wonderful, Josh. My friend, appreciate you, brother. All right. Speaking of Iran, are they trying to murder Donald Trump? Looks like they are. Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee is going to join us next, talk some hurricane, flooding, Iran, and other things. Now, speaking of talk, let's talk about Pure Talk. Yeah. My cell phone company. I don't own it. It's just I love them. For one, I love them because I save so much money. We have four lines. Me, wife, kids, four lines. When I was with T-Mobile, that's who I had before Pure Talk, we were dropping $148 a month for cell phone service. $148 bill a month for friggin' cell phone service. It's crazy. My bill got cut in half when I switched to Pure Talk. On top of being the patriotic cell phone company that supports your values, hires Americans, save you a fortune. And it's easy. You can keep your phone. Your number. You can get a new one if you want. They have those, but all you have to do is go to puretalk.com/JesseTV and switch. So go switch. We'll be back.
Let's turn now to Hurricane Helene. The storm could become one of the deadliest on record. More than 160 people are dead and hundreds more are missing. Scientists say climate change makes these hurricanes larger, stronger, and more deadly because of the historic rainfall.
Anyway, joining me now, the great Senator Marsha Blackburn from the state of Tennessee. Senator, it's so gross to me how these people try to politicize tragedy like what you're going through in the state of Tennessee right now. It's just, honestly, it's inhumane the way they discuss it. It wasn't a discussion about helping these poor people. It, of course, had to tie back to a bunch of commie gobbledygook about climate change. It drives me freaking crazy.
Well, I was so surprised that the first thing she did was talk about climate change and not talk about the response of the federal government to what is an unprecedented disaster, natural disaster event. Jesse, you know, you see the pictures and they're devastating, but when you were on the ground and walking through this and visiting with people and seeing that homes are gone, the foundation is not there. Roads and bridges are washed out, and the amount of response that is there, and the way that neighbors and friends have come together to help those that are in desperate need. And of course, we're still trying to rescue people, and we're still trying to find out who is dead and who is alive. And they want to talk about climate change. And indeed, it is so frustrating. And I have been with the governor twice now to East Tennessee to work on this. Some of our counties still do not have a phone call from FEMA, and we do not know when FEMA is coming in.
Well, maybe those counties should be more equitable. Everyone can remember Kamala Harris saying this back in the day.
It is our lowest income communities and our communities of color that are most impacted by these extreme conditions and impacted by issues that are not of their own making.
And so women.
Absolutely. And so we have to address this in a way that is about giving resources based on equity, understanding that we fight for equality, but we also need to fight for equity, understanding not everyone starts out at the same place.
Senator, obviously these comments are gross. Why hasn't FEMA been everywhere? I understand they can't be everywhere, and I understand it's the government. It's gross, it's stupid, it's inefficient. That's the nature of government, but it doesn't seem like they're that hot on things. They just came out recently, in fact, about an hour ago, and said, sorry, we're fresh out of money. Really?
And the thing is, our disaster emergency declaration was done on Friday, shortly after this occurred. The governor moved swiftly, Senator Hagerty and I moved swiftly. And then the application was made Monday to change it to a major disaster. We have communities in Upper East Tennessee where there are entire communities that are gone. We have county mayors that want to get this aid in. Our TEMA, the National Guard, our Highway Patrol, our local elected officials, our emergency management agencies, our emergency operations centers, they are all going full steam ahead. You have our churches and communities that have come together to help these communities in need that are out helping to clear debris. They're helping to repair roads. They're working to get supplies into areas that are cut off. We have helicopters that are taking supplies of food and water in to keep people alive because they're stranded. These communities are cut off, and I-40 is going to be closed for quite a while. I-26, we've got a bridge. Both sides are out. You have other bridges, five other bridges that are out. You have roads that are damaged. So it is going to be necessary that FEMA come in alongside these communities. We are hopeful that more of our communities are going to hear from them and hear from them quickly, and that the aid that should be going to individuals and businesses will get to them quickly so that life can return to normal in these communities.
Praying for you guys, Senator. I actually hate to move off of this because of what you're going through, but we do have to discuss some world affairs. Iran, Israel, people are concerned, but they have a lot of reasons to be concerned right now. Where is all of this going? Missiles raining down on Tel Aviv. It doesn't look like it's slowing down.
Well, it does not appear to be slowing down. And of course, Israel has the right to defend themselves. And I am one of those that believes we should go in and take out these oil terminals in Iran, and or not we, but Israel should have the right to go in and take out these oil terminals in Iran and hit their pocketbook. You know, the sanctions that President Donald Trump had on Iranian oil, that worked. Iran was broke during President Trump's time. They didn't have money to spend funding their terrorist proxies because Iran is the world's largest sponsor of terrorism, and they spend their money on two things. It is funding terrorism, and it is enriching uranium because they want a nuclear weapon. So I believe that Israel has the right to defend themselves. Israel would do the world a favor by eliminating Hamas, eliminating Hezbollah. And we know that Israel is moving forward on their own.
Senator, speaking of Iran, another thing they spend their money on, at least according to Donald Trump, is trying to murder him. It's quite an eye-popping thing to wake up as an American and see that a foreign nation allegedly has an assassination team or teams here trying to murder the Republican nominee for president. I know you are limited in what you're allowed to tell us, but what can you tell us about this?
We know that Iran has pushed forward. They have made the death threats to President Trump, to former Secretary Pompeo, to Bolton, to Robert O'Brien. We are fully aware of that. And of course, these individuals are entitled to Secret Service protection. And it is quite concerning to us that there have been two assassination attempts on President Trump. And the first attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania, information has been coming out very slowly on that. Congress has said it's just been very difficult for us to get answers from them. We're getting more answers about the situation in Florida, but there again, not quickly enough.
Senator, please keep the... Keep Tennessee going. We appreciate you and your state very much, and we will be praying for all of you. Thank you so much. I love Tennessee, man. Spent a lot of time there. The I-40 shut down. Gosh, I've spent I don't know how many hours on Tennessee. It's just an amazing state, wonderful people. So please keep them in your prayers. All right. Apparently, we all need prayer. Well, we do anyway, right? But the port strike is still going. 48 hours. That's a big deal. What is this strike all about? Is it just greedy workers? What is the impact going to be? What? Let's talk to an expert in this. My friend Ross Kennedy is the expert on all this stuff, and he is about to get you and me a lot smarter. Next. The port strike is a really, really, really big deal. Honestly, with everything else going on between the debate and Israel and everything, maybe the biggest deal for you and me right now is the fact that all the ports on the Eastern Seaboard are currently shut down. It's a big deal. What is going on? Everyone's oversimplifying this. It's not simple. It's very complicated. And so what do we do? Well, let's talk to Ross Kennedy about it, founder of Fortis Analysis. He's one of these supply chain national security expert guys. Whenever I want to steal ideas from someone to make myself sound smart, I steal them from Ross Kennedy. Ross, what's going on with the ports? Why are they shut down?
Well, the upshot is that the port owners and the ship owners, the ocean carriers, have had about 3 years of warning to get negotiating with the International Longshoremen's Association. Represents about 80,000 members, 45,000 of whom are active longshoremen in about 35 different ports on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast. The labor agreement has been coming up. It's known to have been expiring on September 30th, 2024 for years, and they never got their heads around how bad it's going to be. At this point, the longshoremen have two key demands that have not been met. And so they decided to, as of 12:01 a.m. Yesterday on the 1st, they struck. And as of right now, all of those ports are shut down and not moving cargo in and out.
Ross, why 3 years? Let's begin there. You mentioned they had 3 years. They knew this was coming. This is not some big shock. 3 years, and you're going to have a big problem. And here we are, October before an election, and everyone is on strike. Does this have something to do with the election? Is this just people being lazy and negligent? That happens. How can you see this freight train coming for 3 years and not do anything about it?
Well, the reason that I said 3 years is October of 2021 was really when the West Coast supply chain crisis, the logistics connection out there, had really come to a head. That was the peak of when the most vessels were at anchor off the coast of Los Angeles, Long Beach, Seattle, Oakland. And everybody even then was talking about, my gosh, this is really bad now. Number one, what happens if the congestion doesn't clear at any of the ports? Number two, what happens when the ILWU, the West Coast counterpart to the ILA, if their labor contract negotiations in 22 and 23 don't go well? And then what happens in 24 if the East Coast negotiations don't go well with those longshoremen? So everybody was looking at in October of 21 at really what is the lay of the land over the next 36 to 48 months of not only COVID and supply chain congestion, but as well as longshoremen labor. And even at that time, I recall having conversations with a couple of different key executives and different ports authorities, on the Gulf Coast and in the East Coast, and me telling them, guys, you've got to get ahead of this now. Your sticking points are going to be, the fact that we're coming out of COVID. These, guys lost money if they weren't at work. As well as what happens if they go on strike and the role of automation in the ports. So you need to be working ahead of this. And they just kind of hand waved it away and said, yeah, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Right now the house is on fire. And that obviously wasn't done over the last, 12 to 18 months as the negotiation window opened.
I'm going to play. I'm sure everyone has seen this already, but Harold Daggett, he is the head of the Longshoremen Union that is currently on strike. And this video, which was it was from a little while ago, is going around.
Who's going to win here in the long run? You're better off sitting down and let's get a contract and let's move on with this world. And in today's world, I'll cripple you. I will cripple you, and you have no idea.
Ross, I have been loudly complaining about this gentleman for a couple of days, mainly because language like that turns people against the workers. And this is not it's not a simple issue where one side is good and one side is bad, as you have laid out several times. But this kind of language publicly turns the public against you. How could you be such a moron to run your mouth like that? And he did it again after the strike. What is wrong with this guy?
Well, I think what you're seeing there is, big picture, the arrogance of a lot of unions, knowing that, historically, particularly under Democrat administrations, as we have now with the Biden-Harris administration, almost always, the federal government bends the knee, forces the private sector to the table to acquiesce to the demands of the union. And so, number one, that there is very good, valid historical evidence that, they would believe the same thing would happen again here. Number two is that Daggett himself is, as you can tell by his accent, old school New York, East Coast guy who has very, very strong ties to organized crime in his past. And that's not just him personally. That's the Longshoremen Union on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast going back 100 years has had these ties to various criminal underworlds, to the point that in 2005, the former president, who Daggett has succeeded, of the ILA, had a meeting with a Genovese crime family, Genovese mafia family associate, saying, if and when you're gone, I, as a representative of the Genovese family, so to speak, would like to see Howard Daggett become the next president of the ILA. And so, as the history of this individual and of the organization has kind of begun to twist and turn in public, now you're not dealing from a position of unions have historically been pretty arrogant when it comes to their negotiations because they can be, but also the sort of entitlement and language that emanates from someone who's occupied a certain world for a long, long period of time. You pick up the patterns, you pick up the manner of speaking, you pick up the tactics that you use as negotiations, and it comes through in a public setting. And so that's why this individual, you know, wearing his gold chain with his nearly $1 million salary and compensation package, is able to sit there and try to say, hey, I'm the voice of the everyman here. I'm the voice of these 45,000, you know, beat down, underpaid longshoremen who really at the end of the day are just fighting an existential battle against the automation of ports and trying to make more money in the meantime and not really thinking about the impact that their stance has on the U.S. economy, on all these other companies. So it's really the wrong man, the wrong tone in the current time and place. And I think they've really misread the room. I think there's going to be a huge amount of pressure from Wall Street, from a lot of the big companies that are on Wall Street that rely on imports, companies like Apple, companies like Facebook, companies like Walmart, Target, these companies that their supply chains are built overseas, all of the auto companies. These 45,000 guys have chosen this man as the voice of their organization. And he's telling not only Americans and politicians, I will cripple you. He's telling all of the huge companies that depend on this as well, that have their own union constituencies. And it's setting up a really nasty inside baseball type of event happening here at the political level and at the economic level.
Yeah, that's so funny to hear you say that. I said the same thing last night. He sounds like a guy who's used to negotiating with the New York City mayor in 1975 with the Gambino family standing behind him, but it ain't 1975, and now you look terrible. I said the same thing. I'm so glad I was right about that. All right, Ross, I know you don't have a crystal ball. I'm not going to ask you how long this is going to go, but everyone watching this does want to know, what impact might they expect on their own lives? Look, my wife was with her girlfriends at the big box stores yesterday, stocking up on things just in case. What's coming?
Well, when you look at the companies that have, what you would call multi-shore supply chain operations, so that would be a Walmart, for example, that does have the ability to shift cargo with some delay and cost, but and have been. A lot of these companies have been pushing back. You'll see more vessel arrivals to the West Coast, as a ratio of arrivals to the East Coast and the Gulf Coast. So even though they have distribution centers, even though they have operations that are internally linked to assuming that a Savannah or a Norfolk or a Baltimore or a Houston or New York is their primary point of entry, they do have some optionality in their networks to be able to push some things around and bring them in different ways, get them across the country, whatever it may be. So you'll see some, intermittent shortages of certain things with the big guys. With the companies that are really at the most risk, the jobs that are really at the most risk here are the people that are really tied to one port, one location that's impacted by the strike. They will feel this a lot more strongly because if they have one warehouse and distribution and fulfillment center in a Baltimore, for example, every vessel that sits at sea and is not able to call Baltimore and be unloaded, it is likely that a lot of their inventory that they have to have as a company is sitting on that ship, because a lot of companies still haven't learned the lessons of just-in-time being a weakness from the COVID supply chain crunch. They only have the cash to order when they need to order. And that means they have a sensitive arrival window of getting that in. So it's those companies that are really linked geographically to a single port that's impacted by the strike. Those are the ones that are going to really feel it the most strongly, as well as the trucking companies that operate just in that one harbor or in that one port.
Gosh, I don't know why I didn't think about it. I didn't even think about the trucking company, as I was always worried about the trains and everything else. Of course, it's going to freaking affect the trucking. Okay, Ross, final question. They seem like they're a million miles apart. That's what they seem like. You discussed how the workers paid $35,000 a year less than their people on the West Coast. They're worried about automation, which sounds to me like you're fighting against the ocean. You can't avoid that. But they sound a million miles apart, but that's how these things always sound in the beginning. And then you wake up one morning and there's a deal. Are we going to get a deal anytime soon, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say when exactly that will happen, but I know what indicators, I guess, we would look for to say, okay, we're getting close. Number one is that the marine terminal operators, the ports, and the ocean carriers have to find a way to be able to legally pass as much of this disruptiveness and additional cost onto the consumer as possible. In this case, the importers and exporters who pay the bills on every single container. So as soon as they have a strategy for that, that, you know, legally it can pass muster according to the Federal Maritime Commission rules, which, you know, these extra fees are very much something the FMC has been watching over the last couple of years because of the price gouging that the ports and carriers engaged in during COVID. As soon as they figure that out and they say, okay, we know we can pass the cost along, then you will see a deal happen. And the biggest reason for that is that the longshoremen are an aging population of workers that historically only recruits internally, meaning you got to be a friend or a family member to get a job as a longshoreman. It's not like you or I could walk off the street with no connections to the port and be able to get a job. The Wire season 2 showed us exactly how a lot of these things work. It's a very close-knit, incestuous circle. So that reducing population, the demographic decline, if you will, of the longshoreman population is going to drive automation. So that is almost a moot point. And the longshoremen are fighting tooth and nail against that as long as they can, because it only impacts this generation of them and really nobody that follows. So as soon as you see the ship owners and the ports figure out a way to pass along all these extra fees and costs associated with the new higher rates of labor, that's when you'll see a deal happen, because the automation issue is going to take care of itself in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, no doubt. Ross, I could keep you for an hour, my brother. I appreciate you so much. Thanks for making us smart. All right, lighten the mood. Next. All right, it is time to lighten the mood, and slapstick lightens my mood. When a cheerleader takes out a football player, I think it's hilarious. See you tomorrow.